Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to the Lowe Institute. My name is Anthony Bubalo. I'm the Research Director here at the Lowe Institute. It's a real pleasure to welcome today to our In Conversation event, Lise Doucette, the Chief International Correspondent for BBC World and the BBC World Service. As many of you know, she's a multiple award-winning Chief International Correspondent and a senior presenter for BBC World News Television and BBC World Service. She's Canadian-born and spent 15 years as BBC foreign correspondent with postings in Jerusalem, Amman, Tehran, Islamabad, Kabul, and Abidjan before joining the BBC's team of presenters in 99. She's played a key role in the coverage, the BBC's coverage of the Arab Spring, or as we like to call it here, the Arab Uprisings, and spent a lot of time across the Middle East and North Africa reporting on developments in different countries, and was the first Western journalist to enter Qusair in Syria after it was seized by Syrian government forces. She's covered all the major stories in the region for the past 20 years. In fact, we've covered a lot of the same territory. It's been 20 years since I first went to the Middle East as a young diplomat. So we'll spend a bit of time reminiscing as well as talking about some of the things that are happening in the region at the moment. Lise, for me, certainly in the time that I've been in the region, has been one of a handful of reporters that really stood out over the years and whose kind of subtle understanding of the region meant that when she was on the TV, you kind of paid special attention. So it's a real pleasure for me personally to have her with us today. And there's a lot we can go through. We have an hour, but we could talk for a couple at least, I think. But before we kind of turn to our discussion, we're going to play a little clip to give you a bit of an illustration of some of Lise's work.
Qusair is now a ghost town. We drive in under Syrian army escort just hours after it fell to the government. Even on the edges of this city, not a building escaped 3 weeks of intense fighting. The battles raged from shop to shop, from house to house, street to street. Most people fled or are dead. In the heart of Qusair, there's little life in the main square, aside from the troops. The iconic clock tower is still standing, but only just. A new flag was raised early this morning. For nearly a year, Qusair was under rebel control. Today, government troops are marking their victory loudly. This is what like in Qusair, the guns being fired in celebration. The cars blaring their horns as they clog the central square. The Syrian army is declaring victory, but at what a price. Qusair is now destroyed. The streets of Qusair are flooded with fighters and tanks and trucks. They tell us they don't want to speak. And then in the distance, we spot this column on the move and notice something different. Ribbons tied to uniforms in the colors of Lebanon's Hezbollah movement. They speak with Lebanese accents. Off camera, they confirm that. Qusair lies on vital supply lines less than 10 miles from Lebanon's border. It was too important for these allies to lose. But so many civilians lost everything in this battle. We saw very few on the streets today. This man thanks God and the Syrian army that his family is now safe.
But look at your city, it's gone, it's destroyed.
He blames the rebels for his plight. They killed my brother, he tells me. They killed children because we support the government. But still, they're in a rush to leave. Who can say when the thousands who once called Qusair home will be back? Their city became a prize in this war. This battle may not be the last here. Lise Doucette, BBC News, Qusair.
Great, thanks. And we will talk a little bit more specifically about Syria in a moment. It's a remarkable period in the Middle East history. When we look at the last kind of 20 years, the period we've both kind of covered the region, it's hard to point to another kind of time when so much has been happening in the region, where so much seems up for grabs. I mean, and you don't want to kind of generalize, but if you had to kind of, you know, make an overall judgment about what, overall characterization of what's happening in the region, what would it be? Or is it beyond generalization? Do you really have to look at specific cases?
It's a great way to start. But could I just start just a moment saying what a pleasure it is to be here at your very distinguished institute, and to for so many of you to come out on what, of course, is a very balmy winter's day in Sydney. But for me, as a Canadian, it's like a summer's day here for me. So it's an extraordinary delight to be here, even though in principle I'm here for work reasons. And it's also a delight because I have some very dear friends who were also with me in the Middle East when you were there. And Deb Whitmont is here from Four Corners, and Peter McAvoy is also here from Q&A. And we lived through those times then. And when all of us were in the region 20 years ago, that was also an historic time, and a time of some hope across the region, because those were the days just after the signing of the Oslo Accords between the Israelis and the Palestinians, and that anniversary will be marked next month when leaders, historic enemies, stood on the White House lawn and signed an interim agreement. And 20 years on, there still isn't a final peace deal, although they're going to be sitting down in Jericho to try to begin the task again. And if we needed a reminder of how intractable the conflicts are in the Middle East, there's no better reminder than that, if you want to say, a festering sore is still in the Middle East. And you're right to say that these have been absolutely extraordinary times in the Middle East. And I have to say that I've begun to have a bit of sympathy, and in fact a lot of sympathy, for weather forecasters who are always saying, how come you never get the predictions right? You have all that data and you tell us it's going to be sunny and in fact it starts raining. Foolish is the man or woman now who tries to predict what will happen in such a tumultuous environment as in the Middle East, where so much has been torn down and so much has still to be built. And I suppose when you think of the recent history, the most extraordinary of all is the events which were known at the time as the Arab Spring, the Arab Uprising. And I said at the time, I don't know who came up with this word, Arab Spring. It's much maligned now. But at the moment when you were, as I had the privilege to be, on Habib Bourguiba Avenue in Tunis or in Tahrir Square in Cairo, was such a delicious phrase, Arab Spring. Spring because, if you know seasons, spring is such a lovely time of optimism and growth. And Arab because, for any of us who worked in the region, nothing had happened in the Arab world for decades. The political system was ossified. The institutions were distorted. These were countries, by and large, led by authoritarian rulers and presidents for life, who passed it on to, usually in these cases, to their sons. And to see a people, and in the case of Tunisia and Egypt, rising peacefully to make their own history, these were absolutely euphoric times, but sadly all too short-lived. And if you to use the expression we use in journalism, to say fast forward, the historic sweep between what has happened in those life-changing and nation, world-changing events in the early part of 2011 to where we are now, in which we have, call it counter-revolution or efforts to save the revolution in both Egypt and Tunisia, we now have situations where people are again taking to the streets, where politics have shifted back from the ballot box to the street, but the streets are divided and the streets are bloody. And the Islamist forces who came to power in the freest and fairest election the region had ever seen are suddenly now on the defensive and in a very, very dangerous deadlock. And we were having a conversation before and saying that as a Canadian and working within British institutions, I have become so acutely aware of the power and the importance of institutions, because, you know, Abbott and Rudd may not like each other very much, but they have institutions and legitimate political system, a recognized system accepted by all, in rules of the game and rules of law, that they can contain any kind of hostilities and animosities they have. In the countries across the Middle East and North Africa, and so many of them, the institutions were brought down. New institutions are still being built. And there isn't a political culture in which people know how to make compromises, people know how to deal with the enemy, if you like. And so we're ending up in a very, very dangerous deadlock. I don't know what will happen in Cairo in the next few days. I don't know how it will work out in Tunisia. And of course, never mind Syria, which is now a war on every single front, as well as a major humanitarian catastrophe. And I think our responsibility as people who live, you know, far away, is to follow these events. And what has happened also at this time is that not only are they making their own history, is that they're telling all of us and telling major players, even like the United States or big bankrollers like the Qataris and the Emiratis and the Saudis, sorry, this is our time, this is our history. Yes, it's in a mess, but we're going to sort it out. And never mind that you have all this investment in our country. We will work it out in the way that we will. Unfortunately, they don't have the means or the institutions to do that.
I mean, let's go to Syria now. I mean, it's now over 2 years since Assad has remained in power. I mean, you can call it a stalemate. You can say he's got the upper hand now, but he survived. Is the fact that he survived, does it mean that he's effectively won?
Yes, it was. I always keep forgetting the expression that if you're a guerrilla movement, it's not, you don't have to win. It's enough that you don't have to lose. And people are saying that actually this is the same thing with President Assad. It's hard to say he's winning, although his people would say he's winning. And I think this is the important thing to remember. He does have his people. He does have support. He's not a Colonel Gaddafi. This is the man in the front says he doesn't believe me. We can discuss it. I go to Damascus. I go to government held areas. I meet these people who support President Assad. It's not like a Mubarak situation. This is Syria is very much a divided country. But you saw the report that we did from Qusair, and some of you may remember how in the Vietnam War, one of the American generals used that terrible phrase in which he defended the assault on a village and said, well, in order to save the village, we had to destroy it. And this is what's happening time and time again because of the kind of warfare that is happening in Syria, and the sort of the firepower and the tactics that the government uses, and the fact that these are such protracted conflicts. Every time there is a major battle, and whether it's in Bab Amr and Homs, we've seen that the neighborhood of Haldia has now been bitterly fought over. When you visit these areas, it's such a chilling experience. When we went into Homs, I thought later, well, when I went in, perhaps I should have done a piece to camera in that square talking about the extraordinary strategic implications of it having been a battle where, for the first time, Lebanon's Hezbollah movement publicly said, we have joined battle with the Syrian government, which was a crucial factor in the way the government was able to take back the city from the rebels. I could have stood in the square and talked about the important strategic factors in this war, but instead, all I could think about was, where are the people? 30,000 people used to live here anymore, and I only see a handful on the streets. This is a turning point in the war, and everywhere we went for days afterwards, whoever we spoke to talked about the decisive importance of this small town and the government victory there. But it was also a major humanitarian disaster, and right across Syria, every place that there is a battle in the aftermath of battle enduring, people are dying, people are suffering, people are being displaced and being forced to leave their countries.
Okay, but you see, I take your point, you say you're not going to make any predictions, but has he won? I mean, this is the interesting thing about Syria is the kind of the scale on which this is happening, the scale of the humanitarian disaster, and yet the outside world, there tends to be the sense of it of being very blasé towards it. There's almost very immune to the kind of the real suffering that's going on in Syria. There is a kind of sense that, you know, Western policymaking has few good options in Syria. It doesn't really want to pursue it. Does that mean that combination of all those things, the fact that, you know, Western publics are not getting angry about the fact that, mm-hmm. that 100,000 people have died in Syria, you have one of the biggest refugee crises, you know, in modern history. Mm. Does that mean that Assad's basically won?
Well, I think I would want to look at it in a different way to say whether or not Assad is winning or losing, Syria is losing because the country is being torn apart and there is a lot of discussion about the fragmentation of Syria, which is both a territorial fragmentation because certain areas now, for example, the Kurds in the north are effectively running their areas because President Assad doesn't have enough forces to do it, so he's basically subcontracted it to the PYD, the local variant of the Kurdish movement there. It's also splintering because of the sectarian nature of the violence. Communities are turning against each other, and the much vaunted secular mosaic it wasn't a perfect secular mosaic, and I'm sure many will say, well, it was just simply a cover for Assad maintaining himself in power and creating fear among the minority, such as they lived with him. So Syria is losing. The country is being torn apart, and there is a danger of fragmentation, but we all, I think everyone, Syrians most of all, hope that there's enough of a Syrianness about Syria that will keep it together. But no, you're absolutely right. Everybody got Syria wrong, because you'll remember how many times have you read, whether you're reading in the Sydney Morning Herald or International Herald Tribune, a CIA or some intelligence agency or some think tank saying, well, it's a matter of days now, by January of last year, January of this year, Assad will be gone. You know, it's, you know, he won't last. And he has lasted. Now, has he lasted because of his formidable power? There's no doubt the Russian support, the Iranian support, Hezbollah support has made a difference. But there hasn't also been the kind of defections within the Syrian military and intelligence establishment that people were expecting to see. Yes, there have been defections, but not on a scale and of a significance that meant it would be crumbling from within. Assad is also not losing because of the fragmentation in the opposition. That the longer it goes on, the more groups have joined battle. The divisions among the opposition are also growing. It's becoming more and more a global jihad. I was reading when I was here that there are hundreds of Australians who've gone to fight in this war. And more you feel that this war in Syria is not just, it's not about Syria. It's about Qatar and Saudi versus Iran. It's about America versus Russia. It's about the global jihadists who are coming there and fighting a war which has nothing to do with a future for Syria. And it's a terrible, terrible tragedy, which is why I think it makes it difficult to predict, because there are just so many different elements in the mix. And of course, the big question now in Europe, and I don't know whether how much discussion there is here, is to whether, what kind of a military intervention will there be? The head of NATO, most Western governments have said they don't want to put the resources and the commitment necessary for a no-fly zone that we saw in Libya and made all the difference in the removal of President Colonel Gaddafi. But they're moving toward providing arms and ammunition. The United States now is supplying lighter arms to the opposition. We know the Qataris are sending in the kind of surface-to-air missiles that could make a decisive difference. But no one is talking about the kind of significant, decisive military action that would shift the military balance. And that is what it's going to take, because there is such an imbalance now between what the opposition has in terms of their military firepower. They are outgunned and outnumbered by the Syrian military with its air force, that all of this small tinkering at the edges, some will say it will just prolong the war. Others will say, and with some reason, that Assad will only go to the negotiating table and negotiate seriously if he's under military pressure.
But if it's you're making exactly the right point, only if it's decisive. And the sense you get of certainly the kind of these American steps is this is driven much more about deflecting criticism of current US policy. They're not doing enough, rather than it is about making a real difference on the ground. Hmm. And you could even say the same of UK and French policy. The UK and French have been rhetorically at least much more out ahead of the US in terms of, you know, we want to see change in Syria. A little bit more kind of robust in their rhetoric, but practically the difference has not been that great. We're still at a point where there is a very grave reluctance to make that decisive intervention. You know, there are all sorts of well-known reasons for that. The question is, though, you know, can the West afford to keep effectively that non-policy, that wishful thinking policy? That kind of, you got the sense very early on, as you said, that because there was an expectation that Assad was going to go in 3 months or 6 months or whatever it was, that, well, we don't have to come up with an effective policy because he'll go eventually. Here we are down the track with massive, you know, second order consequences for the whole region. And we've still got this sense that, you know, that London, Paris, Washington are kind of twiddling their thumbs, looking around for some good options that you know, admittedly may not exist. But at the same time, you can't really afford simply to let the situation drag on. And have the kind of consequences it's having in the region already.
Yes, you say twiddling of thumbs. I mean, wringing of hands has become the usual response in a world in which nobody can say we don't know what's happening in Syria. Mm. The people, it is difficult for, and dangerous for journalists to operate there, and there are not enough journalists going into Syria. But we know what's happening there, and yet Western policymakers, and not just Western, of course Russia's involved in it as well, the Arab world's involved in it, simply aren't sure what it will take to end this war. Everyone says there will be no military solution, but how do you move from the battlefield to the negotiating table? And I think there is a recognition that this will take years. I read a very good article in which someone said that there were two certainties in the Syrian quagmire. One is, the first certainty is that, you know, back to the decisive military intervention, that will only happen if the United States is engaged. We saw that even if they led from behind in Libya, that the Americans have certain kind of hardware, certain kinds of satellites, certain kinds of military hardware that Europe will need or the Arab world will need if there is to be a military intervention on the scale that would work against President Assad's military machine. So that's certainty one. The second certainty is that no matter how much America becomes involved, they will have zero influence on the post-war situation. And I think, you know, you talked about the factors that are on the minds of Western policymakers in the United States and including the American public. It is the massive interventions in Iraq and Afghanistan, in which they look at it now, the trillions that have been invested there, the lives that were lost, the many, many more lives of people, of soldiers who've gone home and will live with their injuries and the trauma for the rest of their life. In Iraq now, the United States has almost zero influence and no troops. They have some special forces. In Afghanistan now, the wrangling is starting about what influence and what role will the Americans play. They will play some. There will be some kind of a strategic arrangement, I think. So Barack Obama is accused of being a ditherer. He's accused of being someone who doesn't want. He's too cautious. But you can see why he has this kind of caution.
But the problem he has, though, is that even doing the little he's doing, and for good reason. I mean, it's not an argument for a decisive military intervention, kind of conscious of all the reasons why Syria is difficult, not just from the perspective of, you know, the experience that the US has had in Afghanistan and Iraq, but also the particular character of Syria, much more advanced military, much more difficult terrain, all those kinds of things. And yet, doing what we're doing at the moment, the consequences in terms of just Western interests, leaving aside the whole moral question about what's happening in humanitarian terms, you know, were some of Syria's chemical weapons to fall into jihadist hands, the way that the conflict has become a magnet for jihadists from, you know, from as far away as Chechnya, you know, people are even starting to talk about Indonesians going, turning up in Syria, Australians, and that kind of whole retooling of terrorist networks that over a decade were degraded. The capacity for this to spill across borders and to cause serious problems in Jordan, as we see, you can say the US can't afford to make a decisive military intervention, but the question is, can it afford not to?
Well, this is it, and I sometimes say, thank God, I have the kind of job where I only have to write about it, because it is an incredibly difficult situation to decide what exactly should be done. And there was at a moment, we have to remember that, you know, we're dealing with what is both a very short period of time, but what is a very long period of time as well. Because in some ways, if the intervention had been much earlier, Syria would be in a better place today. Far fewer people would have died. The spillover into the neighboring countries would be more limited. And the kind of global jihadist nature of this war and the growing prominence of the Islamist groups with another agenda would be less. There was at a certain moment, I think probably about a year ago, where there started to be this sentiment being expressed by just do something. It is so painful to watch, painful to be in the midst of. Do anything to stop it. Just quick, short, sharp military intervention, all hands on the wheel, just go in and do it. It'll be painful, it'll be destructive. It'll cause major international ruptures, if you like, because Russia will not join this and China, etc. But just do it, just to end it. And I think that was on the mind of a lot of policymakers. I think Britain, they started to think like that. The French started to think like that. And then the moment passed, because whether it was fear, whether it was inability to find the resources, a whole number of factors, they just didn't have the the courage to be able to do something. So now we are where we are, and the longer it goes on, the more difficult it becomes to engage. You know, for example, this idea that there was another idea that was mooted for a while, that why don't you have, in the same way that the Libyan revolution began with the taking of Benghazi, so you had an area within the country where you could operate from, couldn't you do something that in like that in Syria? So the Jordanians were asked to look at Deraa, which is just across the border, and there is an effort there to try to move in from there, but it's running into difficulty because, again, the Syrian forces are really digging in there. They don't want to lose that particular, that strategic frontier. And then they said, well, maybe from the north, because actually when you go in from Turkey, I haven't gone in that way, but journalists who do, when you cross on the Turkish border, there's quite an area where you meet it is completely under rebel control, albeit different rebel groups, but you can go in. And someone was saying to me that they actually went, you know, we had John McCain going in, we had Robert Ford, the US ambassador, went in. They went in a certain amount of the way, and then they realized that the danger of the Al-Qaeda-linked groups fighting with the Free Syrian Army would make that whole area so dangerous that it wouldn't actually be a buffer zone to operate because of the internal dynamics of the opposition movement. Yeah. So again, even that which seemed to be one of the, you kind of, because there is a discussion now, and a discussion which even says that President Assad himself and those around him are discussing this option, in which you leave the north go, you let, you that they will never take back, say, the 70% of Aleppo, the main city in the north that is under opposition control. Let that go, and President Assad, and we see on the ground that there is a strategy, if you like, that there's a whole area between Damascus, Homs in the center. You maintain those highways, which then leads you to the ancestral heartland of the Alawites on the coast, on the Mediterranean, which includes Tartus, which is the last Russian port. Of course, it also includes the territory along the Lebanese border, which is what Hezbollah is really worried about. So just keep that. Let the rebels have those areas. And of course, the sentiment is let the rebels have it, let them destroy and fight each other, etc. And will it fall into that scenario? It's not great for Syria, not great for the region. But the danger is now, and as your question is suggesting, is they should, you know, people of great minds and great resources should also be able to come up with something. But if they don't, by default, it is going to end up tumbling into other scenarios which have their own dangers and consequences.
Of course, one of the problems for people, even with great minds and great resources, is Syria is just one
problem on the menu.
So you mentioned Egypt before. I mean, Egypt seems at a very critical point. Talk a little about what you fear may happen there now after the, you know, what people debate, whether it was a military coup or not military coup. I mean, there was certainly people came out on the streets. There was genuine anger at the President Morsi's kind of mishandling of the first year of his rule, and the kind of move towards more authoritarian structures. But nevertheless, there's no question that the military took a decisive move, and increasingly, it looks like, you know, if it was some debate about whether it was a coup, it certainly looks like a coup today when you look at the kind of measures, the security measures that are being enforced and are being used, particularly against the Brotherhood. So we are really at another crisis point there as well.
It is at a crisis point. It's interesting, John McCain, the US Senator, was in Cairo this week, and Barack Obama asked him and Lindsey Graham, two prominent senators, to go and try to help rescue the situation. And unfortunately, they weren't able to do something. But McCain fell back on that expression, if it walks like a duck, quacks like a duck, it must be a duck. Mm. And he said, we now say the C word, which means coup. Now, the reason why people don't want to say it's a coup in the United States, it has legal consequences, because if the United States says there was a coup in Egypt, it has to stop giving Egypt the $1.5 billion that it has been giving Egypt since the signing of the peace treaty with Israel. So we had John Kerry saying, oh, it was a military action to restore democracy. I've wrestled with this, partly because when I went to Cairo after the military action and went to Tahrir Square, and the place was packed, you know, literally heaving sea of those who backed the military move, and huge sign billboards in English saying this was not a coup. And then in case we didn't get the message as foreign broadcasters, up in laser lights, "This is not a coup" in English, and Brave is the correspondent who will stand there and say, "Well, here I'm Lise Doucette live from Tahrir Square with the supporters of the coup." I have to say there have been moments where being in a country where people made their own history and made it on their own terms, that perhaps they should be allowed also to think about the language in which we describe these historic processes that are unfolding in their country. And in some ways, part of me says our political language has not caught up with the changes on the ground, the unexpected, unprecedented changes. Yes, the military moved in, but it wasn't the kind of coup that we have seen elsewhere. And I'm not trying to defend it, but just to say that they were in discussions with President Morsi. There was a huge and deepening crisis in Egypt. They asked him to do certain things, or discussed, well, I think they probably did ask him to do certain things. They gave him a deadline, if you like, in the next 48 hours, so everyone was on notice. Morsi, now it's all coming out, kind of laughed them off. He thought he had the military under his control. Mm. And then they moved against him. There was also these massive street protests. And again, journalists writing the first rough draft of history are now writing new drafts of history. And it turns out that this lovely, inspiring movement called Tamarud, which is rebellion, which started in the famous coffee shops of Cairo, who said, let's come up with a petition. Let's make history again. And got millions of signatures, allegedly, more signatures of people against Morsi than voted for Morsi. And wallahi, managed to get all these people out, you know, whether it's 32 million or 12 million, whatever it is, and removed Morsi. Now, and then it turns out, but actually this inspiring movement of youth was bankrolled by billionaires like Naguib Sawiris, who from day one, I saw him the day after in Cairo, the day after Morsi was elected, the Muslim Brotherhood president, and, completely, he was not going to rest while this Muslim Brotherhood was still in power, and he didn't. So it was a mixture of elements in which the military saw this crisis developing, and they are the guardians, as they like to tell us all the time, of the Egyptian security and sovereignty. The mood on the streets among the secular liberals, with understandable alarm about the mismanagement of the economy, of the society, of the security situation by the Muslim Brotherhood, we talked about this earlier, the Muslim Brotherhood, and the same for Ennahda in Tunisia, knew that this was their historic moment. The Muslim Brotherhood, 80 years of existence. In Egypt now, there are two institutions that have any solidity: the army, the military, and the Muslim Brotherhood. Mm. They knew they were on notice, both for their own people, for Islamist movement worldwide, as to whether or not they could reconcile the principles of Islam with the principles of democracy. This was a moment for them to be, and Morsi talked about it, "I'm the president of all people," but they acted as the president of the Muslim Brotherhood. At every turn where there was a chance to bring someone from another part of Egyptian society in, they fell back on the Muslim Brotherhood. And the stories that you hear that, you know, the person that he chose for to be head of investment was a guy whose experience was he was a sales manager at Vodafone. The guy for the governor of Luxor was a guy who was behind the killing of the tourists. Yeah. Well, you'd sort of say these are the wrong appointments, President Morsi. But they displayed a lack of understanding and a lack of experience and a lack of vision for Egypt. Now, the question is, some people say, well, okay, fine, but you're trying to build a democracy. You have an electoral system. Wait to the next elections, as you would do in Australia or Canada, the United States. That's the beauty of democracy. You vote them out of power. But such was the concern in Egypt, was that, you know, three more years will be too late. By then, they will have completely destroyed the institutions insofar as the institutions exist, and actually sent Egypt into even greater crisis. And the army, backed by a huge section of Egyptian society, moved. And what you have now is this deadlock. You go to outside the Rabah al-Adawiyya Mosque, and the Muslim Brotherhood is back to what it does best. It's in opposition. It's defending the Muslim Brotherhood. And therefore, it says it's not going to move. And I think it is very difficult for it to move. Mm-hmm. And you had the Qataris, the Emiratis, the Americans, and the Europeans all there, that in itself is extraordinary as well. Never have you had mediators from such different camps all trying to tried to resolve this crisis, and they all left this week saying, sorry, we cannot break this deadlock. They are insisting that Mohamed Morsi, who was a legitimately elected president, you know, not perfect election, but the freest and fairest Egypt has seen, they are right to say that this was, it was a counter-revolutionary move. So legitimacy is their mantra. When Catherine Ashton went in, others have gone in, there's been, I think she's one of the few who's been able to meet him, you know, trying to say, okay, maybe if you're released, and the army has said they're not going to release him, or if other people are released, is there any way you can come back? We can have some kind of a discussion. There are secret talks going on, but so far we haven't seen any indication whether they'll be able to resolve this. And any day now, the army and the police may move in.
And the question is, can you actually have a democratic transition without resolving it? I mean, you make the entirely correct point. You know, historically in Egypt, in Egypt's modern history, there are two constant institutions, like the army and the Brotherhood. And in fact, in many ways, this is a repeat of the revolution that brought Nasser to power, where it was either going to be the military or the Brothers, and the military took it, initially cooperating with the Brothers, and then they moved against the Brotherhood. And in a lot of ways, history is repeating itself. But the question is, can you move to a genuine democratic system, a democratic consolidation, by cutting out of the system one of its largest political players?
They have support. But I have to say as well, and again, back to the beauty of democracy, we all see how when elected governments serve in office, the burdens of governing and the mistakes of governing mean you lose support. But the amount of support which the Muslim Brotherhood seem to have lost in the months between the parliamentary elections, which they did best, and then the presidential election, it went up because people saw their performance. Now, you could say, again, you should give them more time. They're inexperienced in power, but people didn't. You know, can we excuse the people who inspired the world by making history and they say, right, okay, don't like this one, we're going to get rid of them. We did it once, we'll do it again. Yeah. I'm optimistic for Egypt in the long run because I think there is a vibrancy and a resourcefulness and a strength in Egyptian society that means ultimately I think they will sort themselves out, you know, be like Cairo, capital of capitals, symbolic heart of the Arab world. But it is going to go, I think, we may not have seen the worst. And every envoy, every country which has spoken out about Egypt has said, for democracy, democracy has to be inclusive. You can, if you cut out the Muslim Brotherhood, and whether you are cutting out a certain significant percentage of Egyptian society. And if the Muslim Brotherhood comes back and takes part in the next elections, they will again do well in these elections. They will do better than these liberal secular parties who would have never got into the positions they're in now. Mohamed al-Baradei, you know, Nobel laureate, would not have got to the position of being vice president unless the army put him there. Because he doesn't have the electoral support, he doesn't have the constituency that the Muslim Brotherhood has been able to build up in 80 years. How can you compete against a religious/political movement that has been able to exist, obviously underground for a lot of it, through the mosques for most of it, but they have been operating in Egyptian society in a way the liberals, the secularists have not been able to.
Now, I could talk to Liz all afternoon, but I do have an obligation to allow people to ask questions. So please raise your hand and wait for the microphone and tell us who you are before you ask your question. Up the back there.
My name is Nick Chinghan.
Where are you from? What do you do in Australia?
Sorry, I'm the Mission Secretary of the Australian Security Investment Commission.
You want to invest in Egypt?
you mentioned President Morsi's promise, which was largely unfulfilled, to be president for all Egyptians. But I guess it's fair to say that life for minorities in Egypt and perhaps
the Arab world has become harder as a result of the Arab Spring. What's your view on the safety, security, and ultimately the place of minorities, particularly Arab Christians, in the Arab world?
It's a very, very, very good question. When people ask me now about minorities and Christians, I immediately think of what the UN envoy, Lakhdar Brahim, who was recently asked about Christians in Syria, and he came back, this veteran Arab diplomat came back and said, I refuse to call the Christians of Syria a minority. They have been an integral part of Syrian society for millennia, and why would we suddenly, because when you say minority, you have the sense of small community, not at the center of political and social life. In every country now where there has been this historic change, Christians feel that their situation has become much more difficult and much more dangerous. And when, for example, during the elections in Egypt, when we would talk to prominent Christians or Christians from any walk of life, they wouldn't look at, as we did, for example, when you look at what happened in Egypt politically, you say, well, look at what happened in Tunisia, look what happened in Libya. They say, look at what happened in Iraq. After the US-led invasion in 2003, the Christian community was harassed, attacked, endangered, and there was a large-scale exodus out of Iraq. They just simply didn't feel safe there anymore. And what we've seen in recent weeks in Egypt is that this, again, this confrontation between the Muslim Brotherhood and the army is being played out within the Christian community. We have had shootings in the Sinai, a prominent Christian of priests. Families have been attacked. You have this horrible thing of people, of teenagers being thrown off a roof in Alexandria. So Christians are the target. They're a small and vulnerable community, and they're an easy target for more powerful players. I recently was at a conference in Oslo, and I met a bishop who was still in Syria, and he managed to come out, and he is in, it's called the Valley of the Christians. I'm trying to remember the name in Arabic, where there's a small sort of enclave of Christians that are still living there. And this bishop said to me, he said, I'm telling all the Christians who live in my community, please don't leave because we have to keep our presence here. And they say to him, Father, our only weapon to fight in this war is our passport. Because a lot of the Christians have a second passport. And they're thinking not of their place in Syrian society. They're thinking about their children. They're thinking about their family. And they're thinking of trying to find a way out. And I think, you know, we owe it all, I mean, for all the minorities, whether it's Kurds or Turkmens or whatever, that a lot of these people need voices of everyone to try to underline the very, very vulnerable situation they're in now.
Another question from the floor, down the front here.
Ah, here's the man who's going to ask me about that real support for President Assad.
It's a pleasure to have you here.
What is your name?
My name is Fadin Nikchu from Iran. I'm originally
You're from Iran?
I'm from Iran. And the reason I'm a very fan of you and the rest of the colleagues at BBC. Yes, always
now you're
going to
destroy
you.
Me with your... you're telling everyone I'm a fan, and then when you're really, really terrible to me, they'll say, oh, you know.
You are talking to Western audience now, yeah. Australian and American, as Antonio concerns about the, if we can afford to do nothing in Syria, mostly.
Syria.
Yeah. And you said Mr. Assad has support. And the support you know, and
some
I
support.
Know.
I didn't say full support.
Yeah, yeah.
Some.
To me, the support comes from Tehran, mm-hmm. as you know, and Moscow, Putin, Mr. Putin. So the question, the real question is now for you and me and the Western power, as Antonio asked, is to can we afford to let them win? Let them win?
Yeah. These are very... very difficult questions, and they're questions most of all for Syrians, of course, because it is their future. When the peaceful protests, because it started as peaceful protests in Syria, started in March of 2011, people generally said that possibly President Assad and his those around him had about 40% support. Then, as the months went on and people saw that he was willing to use such overwhelming and indiscriminate force against his own people, then every time we went back to Damascus, people said, he's losing support. Because sometimes the percentage of those people, some part of that percentage of people who were supporting him were not supporting him because they genuinely wanted to, but because they saw him as their protector. And when they saw that that wasn't happening, that he was actually attacking his own people, he lost support. But then recently I spoke, and again, we don't have any public opinions. Statistically, it's very difficult to say. So we're just really talking about general balance, if you like. That it's shifting back again. That, you know, even someone very senior in one of the European military establishment, chief of staff, said to me that he felt maybe the support for Assad had gone up to 50%, simply because, as someone put it to me in Damascus last month, that in the minds of Syrian soldiers and in the minds of civilians, if it comes down to a choice, and it hasn't reached that point yet, but it's significant enough that people are asking this question, that they have to choose between Al-Qaeda and Assad, they will choose Assad.
I would choose Assad.
Yeah.
On that.
Yes.
But you know.
But he has been kept in power by, he's got much, much more support than the rebels do, militarily, in every which way, economically as well, even though the economy is in a mess. Without Russia's support, without Iran's support, without Hezbollah's support, he would be in a very, very different situation.
Yeah.
But he still has a significant military establishment. But I should say in all this, actually, is that the other cautionary note one should say that after these events that have unfolded in the Middle East is that for everyone, and I'm sure everyone here has been making their analysis and their assessment of what is happening, you have to keep a corner for the totally unexpected. Because there's always going to be that possibility, and perhaps those who are hoping against hope there will be one, is that someone within Assad's own entourage will move against him. You know, now today they're discussing, was his convoy attacked as he went to the mosque? The government says, ridiculous, it wasn't attacked. The rebels say, yes, it was attacked. We charted his movements. There is, in the mix, the unpredictable, chaotic mix that there is, things could, you know, we could all, you know, we could finish today with me saying, oh, how unpredictable it is, and then tomorrow we wake up and suddenly Assad's been killed by one of his guards, but it hasn't happened yet. So I think we should have a measure of saying we simply don't know what will happen, while still trying to make as reasonable an analysis as we can of the existing military, political, territorial balance on the ground to come to some kind of understanding, even though it's still quite difficult.
Just in here. I'll just wait for the microphone.
As in the Balkans...
Your name? Tell us who you are.
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm Peter Green. I'm actually a TAFE teacher.
You what?
I'm a technical teacher.
Very good.
As in the Balkans, the way to understand it was to actually look back almost before the First World War and the reshaping of the map. Mm. The question is about, do we have to look back towards, say, the end of the Ottoman Empire and the first layer of strong people who came after are now falling, and so the reorganisation of power. Is that a way to read the situation? And if so, where to from here?
It's interesting that you mention that. Please never say, as almost an apology, that you're a technical teacher. We need lots of technical teachers. In fact, some of us may be in a better position had we had better technical teachers. They talk a lot about the maps that were drawn at the end of the First World War and the post-Ottoman Empire, and that this is the first moment since then where there is a, as we hinted at earlier, a very real possibility that borders will be redrawn. Now, hopefully they won't be as they were before with the British and the French carving up their empires, sometimes on the back of envelopes and these sort of notional sort of lines on a map somewhere, where they're dividing what would otherwise be natural boundaries. But for example, just to take one specific, the Kurds, as I mentioned. I meet many Kurdish leaders now who say, we missed our chance in the last century. We missed our chance in the first Gulf War, where the world didn't back us. And there was this great quote that I saw in one of the newspapers that one Kurdish man said, it was like a lightning bolt went through my head. And you have this idea that suddenly he thought, this is our historic moment. We're not going to let it pass this time. And that when, again, this sort of this great tumult and chaos where everything is up for grabs, where in some places where the complaint used to be there was too much state, and now there is no, it was a great, the Hisham Matar, the Libyan novelist, said, we used to fear the power of the state. Now we fear that there is no state. And when there is none, then people can make a grab for it. And I think this is what people are looking now. And what I, as I mentioned, people talk about that there will be an Alawite state that will allow President Assad and his supporters to live. And then there will be a largely Sunni state. There will be a Kurdish area. But of course, Syria is not in isolation. There are Kurds in Iran, Kurds in Iraq, Kurds in Turkey, and these are sovereign states which have more controls over their borders. And I think once you open up the Pandora's box of one community getting greater autonomy, then you're opening up a whole cauldron of problems. So suffice it to say it's being discussed. Suffice it to say that some people are seeing this as a chance to seize their opportunity. But whether or not people will have the courage of their conviction and the resources to back up a significant and fundamental and actually the real redrawing of boundaries will be quite another thing. But people do say that all of those fault lines now go through Damascus.
Liz, I mentioned at the outset, we talked about how we'd kind of more or less covered the same period of time in the region, and I'd ask at least one blast from the past question. Well, the obvious blast from the past question.
He's so nostalgic.
The obvious blast from the past question is the Israeli-Palestinian negotiations. John Kerry, amidst all this kind of turmoil, amidst all these competing priorities, John Kerry made 6 trips to the region in 6 months to get the Israelis and Palestinians negotiating again. We've all kind of seen the multiple rounds of this, and it's hard not to react with a kind of very weary cynicism about where all this is going to go. How do you see the negotiations and the prospects at the moment?
I've been quite fascinated by the John Kerry situation, because just if any of us suddenly were given the job of being the top diplomat for what is still arguably the world's most powerful country, how would you spend your time? What world, when you wake up in the morning, what would you put at the top of your in tray? And there are many critics who are saying, why is John Kerry making 6 months and 6 trips to Israel-Palestine when Syria is imploding?
You call me sentimental, right?
Yes, yes. And Egypt needs our attention. Why is he doing so much? And I think those who praise what he's done recognize that for all of the crises that we've been discussing, that still the festering sore, the canker, if you like, in the Middle East is still the unresolved Israeli-Palestinian conflict. And until you solve that, it is going to still be nipping at your heels no matter what other issue you try to resolve. And I think I would commend John Kerry for making the effort. Some say it's a fool's errand, but I think there is a truth in all of this, in the sense of when situations unravel, when there is the risk of violence, if on top of it the two sides are not talking, then there's an even greater risk that the situation will deteriorate further. Now, the fact that it took him 6 months, and really sometimes around the clock diplomacy, I was in the region some of the times that he was there, going from lunch, dinner, breakfast, going between Jordan, the West Bank, and Israel, is that if it took that long just to get to have talks about talks, how long will it be before you actually can resolve the issues? And there's been this extraordinary paradox, as everyone here, I'm sure all of you here follow in some detail that this particular process, is that everybody knows what has to be done to resolve this conflict. They have been at it for decades, but they know it must be done, but they cannot seem to find a way to get it done. That there isn't enough political will on the side of the Israeli and the Palestinian leadership, and they don't feel that they have the backing. They will both lose politically to do it. I still believe that there is a general majority of support for a peace process, for a two-state solution within Israel and the Palestinian territories. But will they be able to push themselves to make what will be really incredibly painful decisions on borders, on Jerusalem, on the expansion of Jewish settlements, on the right of return? It's still very early to say, and some people are starting to say that, in fact, maybe a final peace deal, resolve this kind of an end of conflict sort of deal, resolving all the issues, may be too much to expect, and he set a 9-month deadline. But maybe they can have a temporary deal. Now, there's a danger in a temporary deal, because we saw in Oslo, one of the great failures was they didn't deal with Jewish settlements, and we see what's happening now, how much they've expanded so much to the point where it may be almost territorially impossible to have two states, because there's not a contiguous territory for the Palestinian state. But so there's still a great risk it won't happen, but I think better to try, and I think John Kerry should be commended for trying to do it, because unless there is sustained American, and it has to be American engagement in this process, it won't happen. Mm. But the truism still is, as the Americans like to say, you can't want peace more than the parties to the conflict want peace. So you see, you've been hearing that for 20 years. The maxims never change, and the situation doesn't really change, except it just gets worse. But, you know, I was in Jericho recently seeing Saeb Erekat, and who's now the main negotiator on this. And I just said, well, what if the at that point, they hadn't agreed that they would get back to the talks. And I said, what will be the consequence if you don't return to the negotiating table? And he just said, well, he wouldn't go into details. He said, the status quo is finished. It's finished. They've already gone to the United Nations to get observer status. They're preparing to go to the International Criminal Court. They're preparing to go to other UN bodies. They're even preparing, although they won't confirm this, the possible dismantling of the Palestinian Authority, which means that Israel, as the occupier, will have to take complete control, because under the rules of war, if you are occupying a territory, you have to provide for all of the care of these territories, which will be a huge financial burden for Israel. Also, never mind the criticism of the rest of the world for being an occupying power. So the stakes are really, really high for Israel, and they're high for the Palestinians as well. So I used to always fall back on this great term by Gramsci, which was the Italian Marxists, which was optimism of the will, pessimism of the intellect, which always seems to characterize a lot of these conflicts. And then one day I said, Lise, for God's sake, that's so yesterday. That's sort of a, you know, old, you know, sort of Cold War sort of concept. So then I started using a more modern one by one of the great moral voices of our time, which is Archbishop Desmond Tutu. Whenever he is asked whether he's an optimist or a pessimist, he kind of gives that that great belly chuckle that Desmond Tutu always gives. And he said, we are a prisoner of our hope.
Yeah. So. it's a great testament to to what's happening in the region, I suppose, that we've talked a lot. We've covered quite a bit of ground, but there's so much that we could have also talked about.
Tunisia,
Jordan, and unfortunately we only have the hour, but it's been a wonderful hour. It's been a great pleasure to have you, and please join me in thanking Lise Youssef.